I'm Jamal, and you're listening to Guess in the Mecha, your weekly anime and manga analysis podcast. From inspiring arcs to game-changing cinematography, I'm on a journey to try and make sense of it all, episode by episode. Enjoy the show. Welcome back to yet another episode of Guess in the Mecha, and in today's episode, we're going to be talking yet again about something really niche that's been living in my head for a long time, and that is this question of what divides anime, or what are the things that divide up an anime episode? This is one of these things that I have been thinking about a bit more lately, because of some of the things that I've watched, and it's given me the chance to reflect on these things. But also it's something that appears to be quite small, but is actually incredibly important, which I feel like is an ongoing theme through a lot of these episodes we've been doing. And so that's something I really want to tackle on this episode. What exactly, in effect, is a divider, be it like an opening, an intertitle card, or anything else? And that's kind of what we're going to be diving into, and more importantly, what does this do for the anime in which we're watching? So I guess there's nothing more to do than just dive right into the episode and talk about dividers of all sorts in anime. This episode is going to take a bit more of a structural approach to things, and something that I don't think I do enough of, to be fair, and so I think this episode allows me to make up for that. I often talk about the contents of the actual things, I think, but I've very much overlooked the positioning of said things in an episode. So often, you know, we talk about animation, we talk about direction, we talk about composition, we talk about all those things, which is cool, but I don't think I don't think I've covered enough where are these compositions within the large or the grander scheme of the episode or the thing I'm talking about. And that's just as important as the thing itself and the actual content itself. Where is it placed? And temporally, where is it within the episode matters so much. And also, what is it doing in terms of where is it located? What is it next to? We're mostly going to be covering the latter in the sense of what do these things work against and where are they in the space of the episode. It's also super important that I outline what I mean by a divider. This isn't really like a technical term or anything that I'm using. Honestly, it was just the best thing I could use to really describe like all of what I was trying to mention. But essentially, as I said before, something that splits up footage or breaks things apart, something that comes in between two sections, making them two sections ultimately. Anime is like a really good place to study this because there are a lot of creators that do this. And I think the episode length and just the overall, I guess, meta of anime lends itself to doing this. Let's start with our first divider, and this is something that we all know and something we all come across literally in almost every episode of almost every show we watch, and that is the opening and ending. And I think this can also be classified as a divider or a means of splitting up content. It's not always used for that intention, but I think it has a lot of utility, and if done correctly or used in the right way, can do a lot for, I guess, splitting things up and changing the pace and influencing how we experience said episode. It's not to say that this doesn't exist today, but I think it's a bit less common now, where we have shows that have the opening at the very start of the episode and then the ending at the tail end without fail, and that's always the thing. We're not really going to be talking about that because that defeats a bit of the purpose of what we're saying, but I should just clarify that those still very much exist. But I think it gets more interesting and relevant to our discussion when we look at openings and endings that aren't exactly placed at the start, but in fact within the episode. Placing the opening within, of course, opens up space for placing stuff at the start, which often I think sets the tone for a lot of the episode, and then the end as well, and placing things afterwards and before that, of course, has its own effects too. Placing something after credits has always had an effect, and we see that in film all the time. Cough, cough, the MCU and comic book movies. It obviously has this massive sort of almost secret feeling sometimes. But if we focus on openings, I think that opens up an entire world of the avant. The avant essentially being footage or a scene or a sequence that takes place before an opening. And that is handled very differently depending on the anime and can be used in so many different ways, which I'll discuss. This is done in too many shows to mention, but we of course have the very practical and sensible sort of event, which kind of just gets the viewer up to speed with the story, for example. So a slight recap of the cliffhanger from last episode is a really good way to do this. Or, you know, going back a few seconds as to what happened before, or starting even with the previously section and recapping that before going to the opening. There are, of course, very practical means for this. And I think this is very good for like weekly viewing. You have a TV show that you haven't seen in a week or a few weeks, and then it comes back and you just get a nice refresher at the beginning. And I don't think those should be like discounted as not having artistic merit, because that's kind of what keeps the overall flow of the show together, I think. Just to throw in an anime example, though, I think this works particularly well with a show like Erased, which is an ongoing murder mystery, I suppose, in parts, or potential murder mystery, since it technically hasn't happened for most of the show. But leading with a bit of a recap and maintaining this really tense atmosphere is really important for a show like Erased. It gets you right back into what you're dealing with, which is actually a really serious incident that's about to happen in a few days or a day or two. And it just really gets you into the atmosphere, really. And that helped me out when I was watching that recently. I think having an opening as a divider also opens up some really strategic uses of the event as well. And comedy anime does this really well. Just the idea of starting a show with a joke or a cold open is kind of like what we were discussing for Erased, but it gets you into a different mood. It gets you into a happy and humorous mood. It gets you into the vibe of the episode. And just starting off light with something is also a really good way to get the viewer comfortable as well. And I think it kind of allows better jokes to land sometimes by starting off with a light joke and then getting into the heavier joke, as opposed to starting with something that would completely overwhelm them, I think is often a good decision. Of course, you can look to shows like Nishijo, Kaguya-sama, and so many more that do this, and it's a really good idea, and it works on me every time, to be fair as well. We can also look at perhaps more planned out ones, not to say that the other ones aren't planned out. I need to quickly interject here and say that there is a factual error in the next thing that I am about to say when I'm talking about Kimono Zume. What I should have said was that not every episode has these out of context events made by a different artist. Some of these episodes simply have very normal sort of events. So I just wanted to make that clear, because I do say every, which is not true. And I guess this is a bit of a teaching moment not to rely on memory when doing research like this, because it often fails you, as it did for me here. So back to the show. But if you look at a show like Kimono Zume, which essentially has different artists handle the event in every episode, it provides just a little bit of extra content and context for the dark and monstrous urban setting, even though the things aren't exactly related to the show itself or directly to the show and the events of the show. It often provides us context to the monsters that which we might see, or just the very gruesome nature of that anime. So I think events also, it's good to consider that there are very different ways of doing these, and the opening opens up these opportunities to really try something that gets you into the vibe and feel of something without directly committing to the plot of the anime, which is usually in the middle, which is usually like, you know, I guess the meat of the show, of the episode. You can do that with an event, or you can go with something a bit more practical and a bit more sensible, which is getting them very much into the bare bones narrative back again, and just preparing them for what's to come. Ending sequences equally can work as really great divisions, and this time I'm actually going to focus on the literal divide itself, and that comes from a movie which I am no stranger to, as I discuss it all the time, and that is the end of Evangelion, of course, which has its ending credits pretty much dead in the middle of the movie, which is very weird, but it works extremely well. And I'd recommend checking out like my whole postmortem on that movie. It's a very old video though, so maybe I don't recommend it actually. But in short, I think it's really good thematically, as it kind of splits up the very different tones of the movie. You have the very destructive Yeah, the very destructive and shocking first part, which is essentially, you know, the world ending. Not to say there's not world ending in the second part, but I think the second part is a much more reflective part of that movie, which allows us to evaluate the rest of that show. And by splitting up the credits, well, using the credits, which are, you know, multiple minutes long, to separate these movies, to separate this movie out, I think changes how we consume it, really, and how we interact with it. Because now I can be the person that then reads into these two sides of the film. But also, I think with the way the first half of the movie ends, with, you know, essentially everything collapsing around Shinji and him finally almost, I guess, waking up to this reality, It ends in a very bleak way, or that first half of the movie and first act ends in this very bleak fashion. But I think by dividing it and then, you know, coming back from that and Shinji awakening himself almost, or escaping from instrumentality, shows that I think you can almost come back from anything. You can come back from the darkness, the deep dark that's in the credits, and change things to your will. He managed to come back from that, even though, you know, things ended, quote unquote, with what should be the end credits in the middle of the movie. So I think the ending is a really interesting aspect. I think it kind of adds into that whole, the naming of the end of Evangelion itself, since, you know, the end was there, but Shinji came back from the end, and Evangelion truly did not end, and he didn't either. So I just find that a really interesting use of using an ending, to be fair. I know I kind of I'm getting lost in this, but I just love this movie so much, so I had to throw that in here. I think it's also important to address a lack of division in the form of an opening and ending as well, as openings and endings can be incredibly important, as I've just pointed out, for dividing content and adding to the thematic ways, or just the messages of whatever said story is trying to tell. But I think having just nothing to divide anything is also massively important, and can be very intentionally used, and almost just change again how we consume said episode or feel about the episode. I think the show that takes this to its almost logical conclusion, and a show that I will not shut up about, is Sonny Boy. And yeah, that show has no opening sequence whatsoever, and has a extremely bare bones ending sequence with, i.e. a song, no special visuals, black background. It's just the default, basically, for what you'd expect from an ending credits, very much like you'd see in a movie, for example. Natsume has discussed this and said that it was really just to give them time to tell the story they wanted to tell, so no opening sequence. But from a viewer perspective, I'd like to add that I think it does a lot for how one experiences Sonny Boy, even if that wasn't its main intention. And I think it allows you to really dive into the world much more. It feels much more atmospheric. It doesn't feel like there's any interference blocking you with the thing. And it also doesn't feel like there isn't a title sequence to tell you this is Sonny Boy. It just is Sonny Boy. It exists naturally and seamlessly in its, I guess, most raw form. I really like that. If you add in, of course, like the very diegetic, natural feeling of the show, from, you know, the footsteps to the ocean sounds and everything in between, it's just such a natural, seamless experience. And I think an opening sequence would kind of ruin that and break it. Like, I did want one at first when I first watched the show. I was like, I can't wait for the Sonny Boy ending, or sorry, opening sequence. I wanted an ending sequence too, of course. But now I think of it, I think it's best left alone. And some shows really excel at this, and Sonny Boy is one of those. Before I get too wrapped up in my favorite things, let's move on and talk about eye catches and title cards. Just to clarify for anyone who doesn't know what an eye catch is, it's essentially a marker of the end of the first half of the episode, usually before a commercial break, and then the almost welcome back card before then diving into the second half of the episode. So it's a bit of a division. And it works really nicely, of course, when it's in its proper format. But in the age of streaming, eye catches have like a really weird place in my opinion, mostly because if you're not watching the show with commercial breaks, it feels very weird because you're essentially kind of just watching two screens show up and nothing in between, and you just get right back into the show. But I still think that they do have a bit of a purpose. They do serve as really nice bites of creativity, though, in my opinion, and often allows the anime and the artist to explore situations that you just wouldn't be able to create in the show or have time to create, because it's often just something completely random. It's sometimes just an illustration that I guess just wouldn't happen in the show, or for an event in the show, or just something, just a situation that just that one's not going to have time to do, or time to illustrate in that very pure, non-contextualized format. When writing up this episode, one of the first eye catches, the most recent favorite eye catch that came to mind personally, were the skate eye catches animated pretty much all by Yoshimichi Kamada, which basically are these almost, I guess, micro films, often about the skaters engaging with one another, and just showing off a bit of their personality and attitude towards skating. He inserts all his little Kanada-style isms, and generally they're just a really great time that give you just a tiny bit more into the characters you've been engaging with for the show. It's not really the positioning. I know that kind of defeats a bit of the purpose of this episode, but it isn't really the exact positioning of where the eye catches are, since they are very fixed. But I would say that that they are just, especially for the earlier episodes, it's a nice way to just get a grasp of a character, even if you don't know that side of the character directly yet, or you're quite not feeling it yet. So it's a really almost shorthand method that can be plopped in the middle of an episode to just create a bit more. I guess it just fleshes the characters out a tiny bit more. I know it's not major, but it's something. And I think that something is still like a really cool thing that you can do. And I prefer to have that in as opposed to have it out most of the time. I think title cards are a bit of a better case here because they can be deployed in a much more strategic way. And when placed right, can actually add a real lot to what we're watching. And I think this has a bit more depth to discuss as opposed to the eye catch, which is a bit more fixed in a certain position, and serves a very specific purpose for wrapping around a commercial break. In terms of title cards, the first thing that came to mind for me when thinking about these were those in AZ6, which manages to make multiple title cards across the episodes work really well in combination with each other, which I think is really cool. And they're definitely, you can tell how well thought out they are throughout the entire show. To me, this is best encapsulated when talking about 86 episode 1 titled Undertaker and contrasting that with episode 22 titled Shin. So there's a scene of her basically writing, and then it cuts back to the Spearhead Squadron, and it just establishes that divide much more because on both sides, or at least on either side, they act extremely different. You know, her in isolation, doing management work and very detached from the battlefield. And then you have this much grander feeling of, I guess, camaraderie, but it's also pretty dark too, as well. They're hiding a lot of pain on the other side. But I think the vast rift between the two sides is established with the title card in this show. And it's a really effective way of cutting away without just, you know, simply cutting away, because I think it makes them feel much further away, just because of that. In contrast, though, episode 22 uses this in its almost most basic fashion, mostly because Shin and Lena finally meet face to face. And so there isn't really, it doesn't really serve much of a purpose besides, you know, just naming who Shin is, and an episode of that is Shin, of course. It serves its most basic purpose being the title of the episode, but because the rift is completely gone, there isn't really that need for this like oppositional usage. So I found that contrast really interesting. And I also find it interesting how these cards are very different in the different parts of the show, where in part one, they are all black, and then in part two, they're all white. And that divide really has, I guess, collapses towards the end, at least between these two individuals. But these title cards are very much about opposition, and it's not afraid to deploy them to create even more opposition throughout the show.
Thank you
Finally, let's talk about intertitles and miscellaneous sort of divisions, which I'm not even sure completely if they're divisions, but I think they're still worth mentioning because they do work very well as, like, I guess, dividing mechanisms or ways of differentiating content from one another. The humble intertitle is probably my favorite way of dividing things up, and I'm going to use actually an academic term which I learned not long ago, at least when I wrote this episode, used by the academic Brad Chisholm for describing what these intertitles are. And these are essentially expository intertitles. Essentially, it's in the name. It's cards that are used to contain written information, and thus like exposition. We've kind of covered this use of expository intertitles before on the podcast, but I want to cover them again because, or cover this one again, because it's just such a great example. And that's how they're used in Evangelion Death True Squared, or Death and Rebirth, whatever you call it. And they're very literal in the sense that they essentially say what's happening and describe what's taking place on screen, but they often amplify what's being said, and it creates this extreme sense of chaos that I love about that recap movie. In terms of the literal divider itself, as opposed to just the content of the division, I think each segment really makes each attack feel more disjointed and almost monster-like because of it. Each segment in that movie, at least that mission, for example, feels much less fluid and more disjointed. Each attack feels like a bite-sized chunk as opposed to a coherent fight sequence. It's extremely rugged and changes the entire pace of how you kind of vibe with that whole sequence as a whole, as opposed to when you're watching in Neon Genesis Evangelion. I kind of just mentioned it, but I think it points out something that's so critical about something like intertitles, which is, yes, intertitles and expository intertitles, they serve as exposition in part, even if it's very bite-sized. But also, I think what's also really key is just the fact that they genuinely manipulate the pace and the feeling of what we're watching because of their like existence and placement. And when you are really intentional with it, like Death and Rebirth is, and like this Shinji versus Sanchio battle, that battle feels completely different. It feels shorter, faster, and ultimately more chaotic just because they're placed in the middle of each action and each bit of dialogue. We can also look to another one of my favorite anime of all time, the Monogatari series, and more specifically Kizu Monogatari, some of the best movies I think ever made, and it's hard to suggest that they have a fully consistent logic in how these, I guess, intertitles are used, which in part is what makes it so interesting and I think feeds into the very surreal aspect of the Monogatari series. It functions more on what feels like instinct on the part of both the director, but also like Araragi's mind as well. It doesn't really have a direct, like, okay, this is placed here when this happens or whatever, but it does just feel almost random. But that's also, again, what makes it so chaotic and unpredictable and a really interesting technique. That being said, though, I still think there are some really cool ways in which these intertitles are used to progress the movie and just change the feel and I guess almost texture of the movie on a bunch of levels. Like the noir card is almost this like cut that separates the different conversations and ideas. It separates the ideas in this very weird way, almost like, you know, it's almost like a computer folder for a very specific idea in a conversation. It almost compartmentalizes it into another part. It's really strange, but that's also like part of the absurdity of that movie. It's very, I guess, cerebral in that regard. You also have some very general Oishi things, like giving words power, I suppose. We could kind of go down this whole turn of calling Monogatari like postmodern in some sort of ways, but that's another conversation. But just in the sense that silence will appear on the screen, for example, and then silence will take place. It's really strange, but I just really adore that. Language isn't just like a myth or pure symbol, but it has like genuine power and imparts itself from reality itself. Once again, a very like postmodern way of thinking about film, which is what I just super love about Tatsuya Oishi's approach to things. And it's just a really critical part, I think, of the Monogatari series, where essentially what we think and believe in our heads shapes reality, and what we believe often manifests into real things. That's why we have all these oddities forming, because it's about what they believe and what they think and their experiences. Those experiences, even if they are not physical, manifest into the real, and or she kind of mirrors that and uses that in the intertitle cards in this way that's very unnerving and but still like very genius. If we move a smidge into the left ever so slightly, we can talk about Akiyuki Shimbo, who's been doing this for a long time as well. Not quite with title cards and expository intertitles, but with just color screens in the middle of episodes and in the middle of ideas. A good, really good example of this is in The Soul Taker. He does this very regularly, and it is very similar to how I was describing in Evangelion Death and Rebirth, just really influencing the pace and making it feel much more unnerving as a result. I guess Oishi takes this to a slightly next level, in my opinion, with the more like postmodern language dimension to it. But I think just the general idea of controlling the pace to signal violence and panic and create this disorientating experience is so interesting, and something that that's why I always go back to them. I always have to like almost drip feed myself with their content or what they make and their art, because it's just so like unique, in my opinion. I always have to go back to it to experience more of that feeling, as unusual as it is sometimes. In a similar respect, another example that I like that isn't perhaps as disorientating, or maybe disorientating in its own way, is the very micro level divisions that take place in Nishijo, and how it's essentially a Nishijo episode is essentially a bunch of segments put together of varying different lengths, some being, you know, like 5 seconds, some being minutes long, and all that. It's a very weirdly constructed episode that works incredibly well. Nishijo has this very unique sort of structural language. I really like that term. I just kind of came up with that recently, and it actually feeds into the show itself and how the show feels as a result. In terms of just the general segmenting of that show and how it's broken up in all these very different sizes, I think that speaks very much to the fact that Nishijo talks about how, you know, the daily life and its very unexpected or expected events come in all different shapes and sizes. It's very representative of what happens within it as well. Life never really comes in the same package every day, but different packages of different dimensions each day. And the size of that show, or at least the sizes of the segments and how they're all cut up in very strange ways, in very uneven ways, speaks to that, I think. It's to the point where I think some of these dividers even emphasize the irony of Nishijo, and I guess the absurdity of a lot of it. And for that, I'd point to the short clips in between bits that have, when I say bit, I mean like a joke, that have genuine scenes of daily life and very mundane life, exactly what you'd expect from a show called Nishijo, daily life. And what's really funny is that, of course, the absurd comedy skits that come afterwards are nothing like most people's daily life. If anything, it's just as wild as anything you'd see in any other weird fantasy anime, or at least on that level. And so I find that really funny how it creates the contrast through these little bits that show like real life, and you know, this is the life you're probably living at an office desk for 8 hours a day, or just sitting in an elevator, standing in an elevator, no one sits in the elevator, I'm standing in an elevator with just awkward music playing. It shows those real life things, and then just shows you a completely different life as well that most people, or if not everyone, does not live. So it's a very micro thing that it's doing, but it's really interesting and something that I think is worth talking about for a show like this, because I think that's what brings out a lot, or at least adds to a lot of the comedy of a show like Nishijo. As always, I think it's always good to talk about what we can learn from this as opposed to just talking about it. And I think the main takeaway from this is that timing and structure are probably just as important as the content of the thing itself and of things themselves. What / where something is placed, or the lack thereof alters the experience entirely. Taking something out, taking these dividers out, would completely rearrange how we feel about these episodes and how we feel about what we're watching, because they're so integral. The food is just as important as the plate you put it on, essentially. It probably doesn't matter that much in real life, but in the case of anime, that's incredibly important. And it's the same for, I guess, just visual medium film as well. And I'm kind of digging at myself here, because of course, I know this podcast for quite a long time now has been very much about that. It's been talking about the shots, which you could argue is a structural thing itself, but it's been talking about the shots, it's been talking about the movement and so on. But like, what is the basis for that? And I think the structure of the episode is a really good way of kind of tapping into that, at least to some extent. And then just on top of that, something we've mentioned many times before, we've discussed it for OPs and EDs, and this applies pretty much to all of these dividers as a whole. It's just the fact that these tools for divvying up an episode or film or whatever often are a display of artist identity and creativity as well. And I think these should be viewed as just as much of a part of the creative vision of the show. The title cards are an intentional part of the vision. Where we place the OP is part of the vision. All of these things are part of the vision and not just like add-ons of fancy bells and whistles that we add in just because we can. No, they have purpose. And we should look at those and interrogate those much more deeply, I think. Thank you for listening to another episode of Gets in the Mecha. That was a bit of a ride for me, particularly towards the end. As you could tell, I had quite a lot of fun recording that. Dividers are weird. And it's, as you can tell, it's been sitting in my head for a while because, you know, I had a wild time trying to get that all out of my head, but I'm glad I did because I had a lot of fun doing this, and hopefully you had a good time listening to. This is the part where I tell you to comment on what you think is interesting about dividers and stuff. So tell me about that. What are your very, if you do think about this, what do you like? What sort of dividers and ways of dividing an episode are you into? Because I think this is like a really fascinating thing. Probably not very fascinating to a lot of people, but I think it can be fascinating to my audience at least. So comment on that. I'd be really interested, and I would love to start a conversation on that. Yeah, thank you for watching. I have really had a good time. I know I'm talking more about myself, but I hope you had a good time too. And yeah, I'll see you next time on another episode of Gets in the Mecha. The music in this episode goes as follows: Chill, Adventure Time Revised, On the Road Again, and Synthwave by Alex. And all this music is done by Alex McCulloch and is under the public domain. I just wanted to talk a bit more openly about why I've been gone, I guess. I didn't want to fit it into the episode because that's just a waste of time, and I'm sure not everyone wants to hear me talk about like, oh, why I haven't been uploading. They just kind of want an upload, and that's fine. So I've decided to slot this in for all the dedicated people that have managed to make it to the end. And there isn't like a massive reason for that. I just wanted to basically point out the fact that I kind of have like these work-life balance issues at the moment, where I want to be doing episodes regularly, but with other commitments and me kind of running up to graduation and things like that, it's a bit difficult for me to like really just go in on the podcast like I perhaps would have a few years ago, or like 2 years ago, which I was back then. So at the moment, it's a bit more strained, honestly. And it's a shame because I really want to be doing episodes on a very regular basis. I have loads of ideas still, but it's just a bit hard to do that with other priorities as well. So the podcast is not dead. It's not going anywhere. It might be on a more constrained schedule than usual, or at least how it was perhaps 2 years ago, but the goal is to keep it going, and hopefully I can ramp things up in 2023. So yeah, hopefully everyone has a great new year. Just wanted to talk about that really. And yeah, see you in the new year. Hope everyone had a great holiday, and bye.